Welcome, everyone. This is the Saturday LaRue Show for May 24th, 2014. It's Memorial Day weekend in the United States. My name's Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic today is the Pacific Pivot for Progress versus the Empire of Death and Extinction. Now, I'm glad we have someone speaking to us directly located there on the Pacific in the San Francisco Bay Area. We welcome Michael Steger, the candidate for Congress, and in the, I think that's the 12th CD where Nancy Pelosi holds it, and the election is June 3rd. I want to get this in right off the bat. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Marcia.
And we also here live with me in the studio is our Asia EIR editor and desk and expert and frequent traveler, Michael Billington. Mike, welcome, Mike.
Good to be here.
Okay. So we have two mics. I'll frequently refer to Mr. Steger and Mr. Billington. But they've been working closely together on Pacific matters and at large, so they may be speaking with each other directly without any mediation of hosts. But I do want to say, we, for reasons of scheduling, we are pre-recording this live on Friday, May 23rd. At the rate things happen, that's important to know. You never know what'll pop in the next 24 hours, so we're here at this time. And what I'd like to do is only briefly set the stage for in a certain way, to ask our listeners to think about where we are in history, because Mr. Billington will give us a situation update, because some very exciting things have been happening, both dangerous exciting and joyful exciting. And what I wanted to say, I was thinking the physical geography of the state of the world is, we have quite a situation where Michael Steger is running for office there. He's doing it in tandem with Keisha Rogers, who is running for the Senate candidacy for the Democratic Party in Texas. And her election is this coming Tuesday, the 27th of May. Anyone listening before then, call your enemies and friends down there and tell them who to vote for, Keisha Rogers. And the two of them have run this joint campaign in the western states, which actually is an international policy intervention, that we should have Obama set aside, impeached, quit, made to resign, whatever you want to say, so we can get on with the tasks of our nation and humanity, instead of being in a countdown to thermonuclear war by his policies, which are really emanating from the dead British Empire. But I mentioned physical geography. Mike Steger is speaking to us from the western states, there in California, where in recent decades, if you take the Pacific Ocean basin as an orientation point, in 50 years ago, we were building dozens of nuclear power plants in the United States and in North America. We had intentions in Mexico, Canada was building. And yet, of the 102 operating plants, something like that, in the United States now, there are barely 20 west of the Mississippi. They were never built out. There was reasons why a lot of them were built in the East and the Great Lakes, in order to have the industrial power to develop the country and to develop our neighbors and develop parts of the world like Africa. But everything was stunted. Now California, I think, of its two nuclear power sites, that's all, which is insane. One of them is not in operation. So you've had a takedown program in the United States, where now we have historic drought in especially Texas, California, also New Mexico, Arizona. It's a food crisis. It's an existence crisis, because of this takedown program and depowering of our nation. Whereas, go to the opposite side of the Pacific Ocean, China, the Russian East Russia and Siberia, and there is a deliberate build-up process underway. Commitment to nuclear power and things Mike Billington can give us the latest on. And so, whereas we are reverting, we are just plunging in the United States to mass harm and through food, energy, and other crises, we're doing things like close to 50% of our railroad freight capacity, carloads annually, is going to just hauling around oil and also coal. And we're calling that success. Whereas China, that does have a large population, is hauling a lot of coal, but they're trying to reduce that by going nuclear. See the two different directionalities. So I'm only sketching this in at the beginning because what's guiding this insanity and this takedown of our economic base in the United States is this Wall Street, City of London, monetarist, but imperial outlook. And the that's where, let me just leave it at that, Mike, Mr. Billington. And I think it's very stark in the recent week or so, the expressions of the commitment from Eurasia and the Indian Pacific Ocean basins. There was an election that's finished in India, of what what directionality is there for the benefit of mankind versus what's prevailing now in the United States, which we want to overturn. And Mike Steger will talk about his leadership campaign to do that. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, as has been discussed many times in this program, Lyndon LaRouche, in seeing the decline and collapse of the United States generally, but especially west of the Mississippi, and long recognizing that the future lies in the Pacific basin, not the transatlantic, given the insane takedown of the economies in Europe and the United States and the current rush for total financial breakdown crisis, had proposed, and we are now carrying through, the idea of a grand project vision for west of the Mississippi all the way to the far western borders of China, Southeast Asia, and the Russian, Asian portion of Russia, and all of Russia for that matter. A Eurasian-American development perspective, which we're in the process now of putting together what we've called the New Landbridge Report, which is global in scope but focused very, very much on this Trans-Pacific region. And we've discussed often that the Obama administration, on behalf of London, said, well, we better take some responsibility for the Pacific, too, to make sure we screw up what Mr. LaRouche and his friends and allies in Asia are putting together. So they launched the so-called pivot. And there are those in the United States, many of whom are collaborating with us, who recognize that the pivot idea is not inherently wrong. We do want to refocus America's interests on the Asia-Pacific, but that what Obama, in fact, intended from the beginning was not the kind of great development projects that that are urgently needed to pull the entire world out from under this rapid decline into a financial and economic disaster and World War III, but rather to do in the Pacific what they've long been doing in Europe. In Europe, I won't go through it here, but you know, we know that with the fall of the Soviet Union, Lyndon and Helga LaRouche said, okay, no more enemy. Let's do away with this Cold War insanity. We don't have the Cold War. Let's develop all of Eurasia. Let's take European and American technology, work with the Russians and the Chinese, and build the entire trans-Eurasian continent as the new frontier for the world, the way America saw a new frontier when we developed the Transcontinental Railroad and developed the West in the first place. So, of course, they didn't do this. Instead, the British, who increasingly totally controlled the United States after the assassination of Kennedy, really dug in. And what we've seen instead is moving NATO further east, right up to the border of Russia, setting up anti-ballistic missile systems along their border, clearly aimed at taking out Russian counterstrike capacity, preparing for war. So when we saw this Ukraine crisis blow up, it had nothing to do with Ukraine per se. This was the opportunity to prepare for war against Russia and China. So what's going on in Asia? Same thing, really, exactly the same thing. What the pivot was the move to prepare, to try to force China, like Russia, to back down to this global financial dictatorship. But, of course, neither have. The idea was, okay, then we have to prepare for war. We adopted the air-sea battle policy, which is a first strike policy against China. And then we began to provoke various phony territorial disputes with Japan and Philippines and Vietnam against China to make it basically justify arguing that China is being aggressive because they want to protect their territorial waters. Just as Ukraine is, or Russia is being called aggressive because they don't want to see fascism reasserted in Europe after having lost 20 million plus people in World War II fighting fascism. And that's called being aggressive. So here we are, posed on the brink of World War III. And you couldn't have a more stark counterposition of the insanity of this British imperial Obama policy to what happened last week when Vladimir Putin visited China, met with Xi Jinping, and they established what actually our very close friend in Korea told me last night. He said, this agreement, this series of agreements between Russia and China will be seen in history as one of the great turning points for, in fact, all of mankind. And I think that's absolutely correct. And ironically, some of the neocon types here in the United States are saying the same thing. They're saying, oh my God, this is disgusting. This is horrible. These horrible nations are going back to 19th century imperial means. This is Krauthammer today in the Washington Post.
Oh dear.
And Zachariah screaming that, my God, we can't manipulate these countries into joining our war on Russia and China because they're getting together. But in fact, what was done in this series of meetings was, on the one hand, the signing of one of the largest gas and oil, primarily gas, deals in the history of mankind. They have agreed, this has been something in the works for a long time, but they now have finally concurred that they will launch a massive 30-year deal, $400 billion project to build pipelines from China, from Russia into China, developing new gas fields in Russia. The Chinese will prepay about $25 billion to help the Russians build these pipelines, develop these new fields. But this is not just a gas and oil agreement. They signed agreements for nuclear collaboration. They signed agreements for high-speed rail collaboration. They launched what will be a proposal was put forward for a new security architecture for basically all of Eurasia, which is not aimed at another bloc, not a Cold War alliance, because many of the countries here are countries that historically were associated with the West in the Cold War, but rather an alliance targeting terrorism, targeting the drug scourge, and so forth. So these are precisely...
And space, right, Mike? Not that you left it
out,
but I believe that's very specific, right?
Yep. Uh-huh. And there were altogether 46 agreements.
Okay.
Some of them had to do with province relationships between sections of Russia and sections of China. And overall, it was just the idea, as Putin said, relations between Russia and China are now at the highest level they've ever been in history. These two great nations of Eurasia are totally focused on development, on uplifting their populations through enhancing productivity, enhancing investments in long-term growth, developing space. Both Russia and China, as we've mentioned many times, the Chinese just landed on the moon in order to mine helium-3 to build fusion power on Earth. And the Russians have just declared that they're going to colonize the moon by 2030. And they're collaborating in these projects. The U.S., on the other hand, under Obama, long ago outlawed any collaboration with Chinese space scientists. And now, because of Ukraine, we have canceled almost all relations with Russia, even though that the only way we can get to our own space station is with Russians taking us there. And most of our military rockets we have to buy from Russia because we've shut down our own economy. So you have a stark contrast between exactly what LaRouche has long said. is that we have to transform humanity back to what was once known as the American system, a commitment to the idea that human creativity is the basis for sovereign nation states working with each other, developing the kind of vision for the future and implementing that vision, which has now been carried out by Russia and China. And if we don't get rid of Obama quickly, break this British imperial policy, then the United States is not only going to be left out of this, but we're going to be dragged into an insane war whose only purpose is to maintain the power of the bankrupt financial systems in the West by destroying what, in fact, is the push for human development being expressed now by Russia and China.
Right. And one footnote, because then I want to turn to San Francisco and Mike Steger there. But my the Indian elections, there is a new prime minister who was the former governor of Gujarat state who went back and forth, I understand, to China a lot. And potentially this is an opportunity, a potential for the same direction of joining up with what you just described.
Both China and Russia. He's made very clear that he is not interested in being a puppet to this bankrupt Western financial empire, that he's going to maintain close relations with both Russia and China, which means that, but again, Lynn used to identify as the Russia-China-India nexus, these three great historic nations, are in a position to move far more closely together.
Right. And I'd like to remind our listeners, many of them do listen because they know the ERR website well, and are that we've shoved out as much as possible of write-ups of the kind of developments that Mike was just talking about. He himself, on the May 1st EIR, Mike Billington wrote a feature story on Obama's failed Asia trip. Obama did this trip in April. And Mike's article is Obama's failed Asia trip, nothing left but war. And this headline is borne out in daily events. But also otherwise, we are covering these the proposals from China, and Mike may get into it too, but the a leading delegation of 140 people from China just finished a trip to Africa, so that this Pacific kind of process Mike just described, there were proposals made by China of multi-billions of dollars of investment, especially in rail and other hardcore infrastructure in Africa that are now active. But Mike Steger, you may want to comment in any way you wish, but I'm reminded of a presentation you gave in a joint town hall video event held in California in different locations, in San Francisco, and San Antonio, I believe, but several places in Texas with Keisha Rogers. And you gave a presentation that was on the recognized the 2014 as a very important historic anniversary, but an opportunity to mobilize. So would you go ahead and comment further on this this question of our historic where we stand right now?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's interesting. In discussions over the last few weeks, Mr. LaRouche, with his associates, had mentioned the fact that Obama has failed in accomplishing the provocation towards a broader, larger world war and nuclear war. That the provocations towards both Russia and China, obviously Russia far more explicit, obviously, though, with the tensions around China with the Western China terrorist operations, which we've seen flare up again just recently, the comments he made in Japan over the Diu, these uninhabited islands that are contested between China and Japan, the flare-ups then again in Vietnam. So clearly there have been major attempts by Obama, but the fact is that they failed. They failed to actually provoke it. And what has happened and what Mike just laid out was an intensification of collaboration between Russia and China in a very effective way. Not only is it the high-speed rail, the space exploration, the nuclear power, in addition to the big gas deal, There's also, you know, they're going to trade according to their own currencies. They're not going to be based in this West. Really, they're separating themselves from this bankrupt financial system, this dollar, the current dollar-based system under British direction. So because of that failure by Obama to launch this war, and really it is Obama, there are insane factors in the Senate, there are insane factors in Congress and in the media, but really it is instigated by Obama. And without Obama able to provoke this kind of conflict, Mr. LaRouche was explicit and said the British would have to come out in their own name to provoke this war. And the British monarchy, not the British people, not the British subjects, the members of the UK, but the monarchy itself, because they were the driving force behind this conflict. And of course, now just in the last couple of days, which is getting a lot of headlines and attention, Prince Charles, who's now more or less the reigning sovereign of Canada, as the Queen kind of distributes her responsibilities, came out and called the president of Russia, you know, a Hitler. And this has caused huge waves. You see it clearly as an aggressive posture by the head of state or the future head of state of Great Britain. And it is explicitly this idea of a drive for world war in the name of the British monarchy and the British Empire itself. The irony of it is that a recent documentary has been released. It's actually about 3 years old now, which documents Prince Charles, his father, Prince Philip, and other British intelligence roles in the murder of Diana. But in that documentary, it also shows that this British monarchy direct lineage goes right back to Nazi supporters of Hitler. Prince Philip's sisters were all married to SS members. Prince Philip, so Prince Charles's aunts, more or less, are Nazis. There's photos now circulating of Prince Harry in Nazi garb, which happened a few years ago. And so the real Nazis are really in the house, I guess you call it the House of Windsor, if it's not House of Goethe and their German lineage. But the reality is that this is exactly what Mr. LaRouche said. I think it's incredibly provocative. At the same time, you see the British monarchy coming out with an attack upon the LaRouche organization and really identifying Lynn, identifying the campaign by Ms. Rogers, by Keisha in Texas, for U.S. Senate. And then, you know, in some ways, the campaign here in San Francisco, because it does reflect what's happening here in San Francisco. And really, you do see it. We are catalyzing the three main populations that we're organizing in San Francisco are the Chinese, which are a third of the city, the Russian community, which is significant and substantial. The Russians had kind of colonized this area back in the early 1800s. And have had a population here, you know, for quite some time. And then the Hispanic population, mostly Mexican, El Salvadorans, and some others from Central America. And all of these groups despise Obama. They despise the current financial and economic paradigm of the United States. This kind of green, you know, Wall Street and windmills is what I call it. You know, it doesn't do much for growth. And so we've got these campaigns. What Mr. LaRouche has done, and offering these programs to Russia and China over the last 2 to 3 decades, you really see it. The British monarchy has come out, going for world war, attacking Mr. LaRouche because they are vulnerable, and they see the situation can break, and it can break in the favor of mankind and not in the favor of their monarchy or their empire. And I think that's what we've got to really emphasize today and in this upcoming period.
Right. And let me just, the point you began with, that there's these provocations by Obama, that there's a string that are failing. You see him doing this. Mike Billington, you found in Obama's April 22nd to 29th tour in Asia that likewise people there already knew that or could see through this, knew that he, back in the United States, didn't have support. Is that what you pointed
absolutely.
Out?
Absolutely. Let me just mention one thing on what Michael said. The this movie about Lady Di, which went through the whole Hitler connection to the royal family, that and more was picked up today by Russia Today, the English-language Russian news service. which it didn't quote the video, but it quoted all that material. In other words, their response to this atrocity of Charles equating Putin with Hitler, as, like I mentioned, the Russians who, you know, lost 20-some million people to this Nazi atrocity, and they're watching it rebuilt on their border in Ukraine. And here's Prince Charles, who, as they show in great detail in this report, is himself part of a Nazi family connection, has been throughout history, and they're simply restoring it again today. To see how that's working in Asia, I think if you look, if you visualize a map in your head of Asia, and just I'm going to just mention six spots going from north to south are on China's border, any one of which could be instigated as a spark for war at any minute, given the air-sea battle policy, the first strike policy of Obama, which is the official policy and which says simply that if there is a conflict in the South China Sea or the East China Sea, if there's some threat that we're going to be excluded from these territories, this is a justification for war, and in this case, the war would be a first strike attack on all of China's nuclear and industrial capacities. This is the insanity in which we live today. So just picture this map. You've got North Korea. And, of course, while Obama was on his failed trip, he tried desperately to get the South Koreans to join with him in wild denunciations of the North and to join up with Japan and the United States in confrontation with China. Well, the South Koreans want nothing to do with that. They know that the only hope for a truth, peaceful solution in Korea is to work with Russia and China on great development projects. And while the Russia-China meetings did not explicitly discuss North Korea, because they don't want to do things that don't have public endorsement from the North, they did discuss joint collaboration on high-speed rail projects, and some of the gas and oil projects have to do with building rail and pipeline through North Korea, which, of course, gives North Korea a stake in peace, which is sane. Any attempt to say either you do what we say or we're going to go to war, well, the North Koreans can see what happened to Iraq when they gave up their nuclear program, what happened to Libya when they gave up their nuclear program. So they're not going to respond by saying, yes, okay, we'll put down our nuclear program and you can blow us to smithereens. Thank you. This is one spot. There was an exchange of fire just yesterday, but I think in general things are actually moving towards peace there because the South Koreans are sane and want to work with Russia and China to have a real solution. Now move a little bit south. You have Japan, who, as Michael mentioned, while Obama was there, the U.S. pledged that we would use our full nuclear forces to defend a few rocks out in the East China Sea. This is the first time a president has gone beyond our official policy, which is that we don't take sides on territorial disputes. Instead, Obama said, nuclear war, buddy, unless you do what we say. If somebody provokes a little conflict out there, you're going to get nuked. And then a few days ago, the prime minister in Japan, who's a mixed bag, but who has been pushed by Obama into becoming more and more militarist, set the stage for essentially doing away with the post-war constitution prepared by the Japanese people to avoid the horror of what they'd just gone through in World War II with the support of our great general, Douglas MacArthur, which is a pacifist constitution. It says Japan will not engage in wars, period. Well, that's now being, quote, reinterpreted by Mr. Abe and some of the hawks there to say, well, we won't engage in war that we initiate, but if somebody else initiates, or not even initiates, if there is a war with one of our allies, like the U.S. or even the Philippines or something, we can go in and help our friends, i.e. we can be full collaborators in this aggressive war against China. This is not necessarily going to sell in Japan, I should mention. This is going to be a big fight in Japan. Now move a little bit south. You have Taiwan. And of course, historically, Taiwan is crucial to China. I won't go through the whole history of this. People know the so-called One China policy. They've both Taiwan and Beijing agreed that they would both agree that there is only one China. They just disagree over who rules it or who should rule it. As long as the Taiwanese government was moving towards closer collaboration with China, it was moving towards a long-term peace. Well, just in the last month, NGOs run by the U.S. and by the Green Movement internationally launched two offensives in Taiwan. They occupied the parliament and forced the government to basically say they'd never make a deal with the mainland again that didn't have people power support. God knows what that's going to mean. And then the same group basically launched a campaign, including hunger strikes, to shut down the building of the fourth nuclear power plant being constructed at great expense over a long period of time, almost near completion. And they forced the government to back down to this. This is moving towards a crisis that could spark World War III in a minute. Then you have Vietnam. I'm sure everyone has seen what happened when the Chinese set up an oil rig close to one of their islands in the Paracels, which are contested, but which are under the administration of China and have been for many, many years, where they're building cities and things. But they built an oil rig, and Vietnam was pushed by reasons I don't completely understand, but obviously to their own detriment, to send their warships in there to try to stop it. It led to a confrontation. And this Vietnamese government was belligerently mouthing Obama-type words about China aggression, and their population went berserk, instigated by provocateurs. We're going to have to get on top of who these provocateurs were, but it resulted in the rioting and the destruction of hundreds of businesses in Vietnam, not only Chinese, but many of them by Taiwan, and even some Korean and Singapore companies burned to the ground, hundreds destroyed, 20 or 30 people killed in a steel mill being constructed that will be the biggest steel mill of all of Asia. So the Vietnamese government now knows that they made a horrible, horrible mistake. Their economy is in great danger. The Chinese are leaving in droves. Taiwanese are leaving. They may never build this steel mill. And how they're going to get out of it at this point is, I think, depends on our getting rid of Obama. And lastly, Thailand, you're probably all aware that over the last 2 days, the military formally declared a coup. This has been a long time coming, but the intent here is to destroy China's collaboration with Thailand, to shut down the high-speed rail that China is building through Thailand down to Singapore and cross the country from Vietnam into Myanmar, to shut down the great water projects that are being developed there with Korean assistance, and to return to the green ideology of this degenerate monarchy in Thailand, which is totally subservient to the horse-faced queen in London. So this is British through and through, with Obama cheering them on every front, even though officially the U.S. does not approve a complete military takeover in Thailand. We'll see how that proceeds. But it could be civil war virtually any minute. So that I just review that to give you a sense of how close the world is to thermonuclear war, even as the great leaders of the world, all of whom, and especially Russia and China, have a great deal of debt to the ideas of Lyndon LaRouche. We could review the history of Lynn's personal role in Russia and China, and how virtually every one of these programs being implemented right now go back to policies that Lynn and Helga LaRouche began developing in great detail back in the 1990s and throughout this last decade.
Well, thank you. That paints it very vividly. And Mike Steger, back to you in California. There you are. You mentioned the constituencies. Some with a long pedigree of Chinese, Russian, Hispanics in your own CD, but in the state and in the Western states and nationally, you are leading the charge, as I've said before, that we need to set aside Obama and get on with tasks. And if you want to go into any of that, I know you've spoken about the conceptualization we must have of our planet in the largest sense of universe when it comes to understanding where we're going to get water, and also the situation with the once great national laboratories we used to have in Berkeley, Livermore, and down in Southern California. Why don't you go ahead and speak of the campaign? I stress to people, June 3rd is your primary election date.
That's correct, yeah. This election has two factors to it. Obviously, just to keep a certain focus, since Keisha's election here is just a couple of days away, practically, what Keisha's campaign in Texas represents is really a real shock to the entire current two-party control of American politics in a very substantial way, and really demonstrates the potential of a LaRouche program to unify 75-80% of the United States population, which it does exist. If you're out on the streets, you see this. And there's no difference between the rest of the country and even places like San Francisco. So topically, you might think differently given some of the standout, cultural failures of San Francisco. A lot of the modern-day Democratic Party issues have been incubated here the city. Uh-huh. Things like, the rights to abortion. I mean, you have to think about the insanity of that just in terms of how bad it's gotten, that women's rights means the rights to abort your pregnancy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's really women's rights anymore.
Legalizing dope. I mean, I'm not coaching you on the list, but we do.
The list is long, right? All these things they really have been incubated in this kind of cultural insanity of San Francisco since the 1960s. But the fact is that the actual demographics of San Francisco are much like the rest of the nation. You have a lot of people who are still remaining in the city, a lot of the immigrant populations, who are really responding to an idea of an economic development, plain and simple. That's what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. You can divide people on a lot of issues. That's always been the case, but this single issue. So the campaign in San Francisco really is a referendum on two things. One, Obama is despised. And even in San Francisco, where you'll find hysterical support for him still among some of the most degenerate of the population, the majority of the population in San Francisco recognize this guy is criminal and destructive to the nation and to mankind generally, and is a fraud and a liar at best, and at worst is a genocidalist. And that's just clear. So we're really pushing this issue. We've got freeway banners, signs up all over the main thoroughfares of the city that are state highways that give you access to put signs up. We've got tables all over the city into all the main neighborhoods. We're statuary in Chinatown. We've had meetings with some of the Chinese leadership every week for the last 2 or 3 months. They have different representative groups called benevolent associations that go back to the 1840s, who are still prominent in terms of immigration, business, education, legal questions for the community. So, what we found is a very big response because of the role our organization has played in China over the last 20 to 30 years. The orientation we have around the Eurasian Land Bridge, around projects like the Bering Strait, which all of a sudden have come back to the surface even in discussion from China, where the Chinese Academy of Engineering has brought that back to the surface. So the referendum on Obama is clear. That is out there. It is impeach Obama, and the crimes are long and listed. And it's not irrelevant to say that Nancy Pelosi was the person who basically enabled the dictatorship of Obama's presidency. I mean, this is the woman who, as Speaker of the House in 2006, the first act she made as Speaker of the House literally was to take impeachment of Cheney, impeachment of this executive dictatorship off the table, and basically endorsed the torture programs, the spying, the illegal wars, the drones, what became the bailout program. All of that became a Democratic Party endorsed program under Nancy Pelosi. And so she should be condemned rightly for that program in this election. We'll see what we can muster within the population here. But the second thing is what you pointed to. It isn't just a condemnation and referendum against Obama. The people in the Bay Area represent, there are still major institutions here of a scientific caliber, critical for mankind's survival. Obviously, like you mentioned, we have two nuclear power plants. One is basically out of commission. I mean, the state is literally falling apart. I mean, we've got 49th in the country in education. The drought has been devastating. Wildfires are now breaking out and ravaging entire areas of the state very early. This is still very early for fire season, and it's already happening. There is no economic recovery. It's all been a Wall Street bailout to places like Silicon Valley, real estate bubble. There is no, California is literally a dying state. The point, though, is that the scientific questions of what we represent as a species. And I think this is unique. You know, what we had committed to in the United States coming out of World War II, even if it wasn't politically committed to in the same way as Roosevelt or as Kennedy briefly had, but people like Reagan, other people inside American politics, the LaRouche Organization, there were key scientific institutions that recognized we were at a different point. We were at a point now where war had become obsolete. As Douglas MacArthur had said, great war now could no longer exist because it was now existential. It wasn't a victor and a loser. It was that the potential annihilation of mankind. That kind of thermonuclear power also presented an incredible opportunity. If that power was harnessed in productive use, in scientific use, you would transform the characteristic of the human species. You would see an evolutionary upshift of a higher magnitude once mankind integrated thermonuclear fusion technology and energy into its overall social practice and economic practices. That meant not only transforming our resources, addressing the water and drought and other weather and climatic problems that we encounter that are devastating the Western states today. I mean, our food supply is at risk because we did not develop this kind of technology. We did not maintain a commitment in this direction. But it also, further, we would have expanded our ability to even look at, as is now discussed by both the Chinese and the Russians, what are the resources on the moon, one of which is helium-3 that can be used for fusion. But we can expand our scope of the questions we're asking, the domain of which we're able to effectively act upon, the resources we're able to manage, and that the current problems we have today are so small in scope compared to this kind of, you know, breakthrough in human activity. That poverty, hunger, water shortages, diseases, I mean, we still have diseases like polio breaking out in areas of the Middle East today. This is criminal. This is criminal. What's happening in Africa, what's happening in Sudan is criminal. It's a British Empire genocidal program, and it's criminal. The only alternative to it is this kind of breakthrough in fusion. And, you know, what's interesting, I guess, to end on it in terms of this area, at least for now, the collaboration with Russia and China, with the United States, and with India, and with Japan, and South Korea, that is probably the most potential fertile collaboration, politically, scientifically, and economically, directed toward these kinds of large development projects, and specifically of fusion energy. And that really is, that is out front at this campaign. I think it's out front in terms of where mankind has to go. And that really is the post-Obama domain. That is it. It's a specific collaboration around these questions, which is very exciting. And hopefully, if the population is moralized enough, if they're, you know, charged up enough to actually take some responsibility, we can take this kind of debate into November with both Keisha and mine campaign, and we'll just have to see how that breaks down.
Let me add what Michael was discussing in terms of where the best collaboration is with Asia. That is the American system. This is the history of the best history of America, was that we recognized that going towards the Pacific was the opening up of the American system to the entire world. We were going to take this American system to Asia to beat back the British Empire that had been controlling all of Asia back in the 19th century. And the great Chinese revolutionary leader, Sun Yat-sen, who had studied the American system when he was in Hawaii as a young lad, met up with people connected to the great Philadelphia School of Nation Builders, the Henry Carey School, and was taught the American system and the British system and learned to despise that and saw how the British system was already trying to subvert the United States. And he recognized the differences between Hamilton and Jefferson. He recognized the role of Abraham Lincoln in fighting the British in the colonial the Confederacy in the South. And his idea at the time was to build a massive rail project crisscrossing China. He said to the West, okay, you just went through this horrendous world war, World War One, nearly destroying the world. Now, if you want to avoid another one, he said, let's put that tremendous productive power that was wasted building war machines to work building China and the rest of the world. But start with China, which is where you can really spark the entire world. And he designed a great rail project for all of China, reaching out into Russia, into the Central Asia, down into Southeast Asia, exactly the kind of three-pronged land bridge idea, New Silk Road idea that Lin and Helga LaRouche have championed since the 1990s. That this policy was subverted, it never was developed until now. I mean, in a real sense, I think you can look at what Xi Jinping is doing with the New Silk Road, the new maritime Silk Road, and what Marcia mentioned a minute ago, this trip by Li Keqiang to Africa, where they said, okay, Africa is still a backward semi-colonial area. Why? Because they never had any infrastructure development. The only railroads you had in Africa was where the colonial powers built a railroad from the mines to the port, and different grades so that they couldn't connect the countries of Africa together. Well, Li Keqiang, the premier of China, said, okay, we're going to build high-speed rails to connect every single capital of Africa. Now, that is the most powerful anti-imperial, anti-colonial policy that you could possibly imagine. And I can't quote it. I didn't bring the quote with me. But Sun Yat-sen said when he in one of his writings from the 1910s and early 20s, he said, when we develop China with this great international development process, and when in the future we've become a powerful developed nation, we must remember that we say to the rest of the third world, we remember we lived through colonial looting. We will never do that to anybody else. This is a pledge that we must instill in ourselves and convey to the rest of the world. And that's why China was still backward. So Li Keqiang in Africa gave a speech in which he didn't quote Sun Yat-sen, but he paraphrased that idea. He said, we experienced the hell of colonialism, and we've escaped it. We have some things we can advise you on, but we're not going to impose any system on you. We're going to prevent that kind of imperial looting from taking place, and we'll do everything we can to help you to escape this kind of hell that you're still living through today. So this is the real American history, not only the real Chinese history. It's something that we have to bring to the American people today. And I know Michael out there is organizing the Chinese community because, as I think I heard you say in another speech, Michael, that the Chinese community in San Francisco is the most American community there is out there, precisely because they treasure this American system, which has been so destroyed, so lost here in America itself. But that this is what we can and we must use to inspire Americans and people from every part of the world to the kind of great potential that this horrible disaster that we're facing can spark. And I'll mention one more thing since our time is running out.
That's all right.
Both Russia and China are looking at this insanity with a certain recognition that this could be a blessing in disguise. Our very good friend Sergei Glazyev, the top advisor to Putin, the man who brought Lyndon LaRouche to Russia to speak to the Duma there, and whose book we translated into English on genocide, the policy imposed on Russia during the 1990s by the Western oligarchs, that he has said, and he repeated yesterday at a meeting in St. Petersburg, he said, look, this is a blessing in disguise because we've allowed ourselves to be dragged into this Western monetarist ideology where we've put the money from our oil wealth into Western banks. We bought stocks. We got tied up in all kinds of financial speculation instead of building our nation not as a raw material exporter, but again as a great industrial nation with infrastructure, industry, agriculture, and so on. So let's take advantage of these stupid sanctions, which are doing more damage to Europe and America than they are to us. But at least it gives us a wake-up call. Let's adopt a, and he doesn't call it a Hamiltonian system, but a credit system where we issue ruble credits to replace these dollar loans that we have, and that we direct, we use the power of government like we did in America under Hamilton, under the National Bank. We direct this credit generation into building the nation, uplifting the productive powers of our population, building industry, agriculture, and above all, great infrastructure projects. Let's work with China. Let's do the land bridge development. And I'll close by saying, in China, something similar happened yesterday, where, as I'm sure you all know, Obama just launched criminal assault against five top officers of the Chinese military for the horrible crime of spying, cyber crime against America. This, I mean, I can't imagine anybody in the human race not just doubling over in laughter at these charges after the Snowden revelations of what the U.S. NSA has done. We took over the biggest IT company in China, Huawei. We demanded that other countries like Korea not hire Huawei to do their systems in order to support our own. And here we are bringing criminal charges against five supposed hackers. So anyway, this is laughable. But how's China responding? Well, they announced yesterday that they're going to do a thorough investigation of all of the Western IT companies, and that means, Intel, Microsoft, Apple, all of them. And if they are not willing to give over their encryption policies to China so they can check to see if they're being used as a front for the NSA, they're going to be banned from China. Now, this, of course, is the biggest IT market in the world. And at the same time, like Glazyev said, in those areas that we're deficit in science and technology, we damn well ought to build our own. We should not be depending on Western sources. And the Chinese are saying the same thing. We have to develop our own systems that can replace these corrupted systems that are being used not only to spy on our population, but to manipulate and control our industries, our military, and so forth. So this does not mean that they're trying to circle the wagons and say to hell with the West. They know very well that they can't just dismiss the West, because, in fact, that would mean that the U.S. would emerge as it is now as the new fascist power, and that they would blow up the world in a war. And they, therefore, are very much dependent on us, on you and me and all of us on this call today, to recognize that we have an awesome responsibility to end this tyranny in IT and warmongering and so forth, to end it today. And they're counting on us. They see LaRouche movement as the link. They're watching these campaigns as close, in Keisha and Michael's campaigns, as closely as anybody else in this country, because they know it's a demonstration that there's sanity somewhere in America, and that if we awaken the sleeping giant and get the Americans thinking like Americans again, that in fact this could bring the world into a great new renaissance instead of a great new thermonuclear war.
Yes, and speaking of what they're seeing, and then Mike Steger, I have a final question to put to you, or you can use the final minutes any way you choose. But it was only, it was only a couple of weeks ago that our chief of staff, the military leader, General Martin Dempsey, hosted the Chinese commander, Fong, I believe, and in the proper fashion with briefings, with a meeting, with follow-up, with cordiality, with the proper protocol and so forth. And this came barely 7 days or fewer before this announcement by Eric Holder, the Attorney General, on behalf of the White House of these charges against military.
Yeah. In a sense, those charges were as much an attack on our own military.
That's it.
as they were against the Chinese military.
So that's my question to you, Mike Steger. In other words, it was an attack. You can see it's so stark, the fight amidst our national institutions, our military, our medical institutions, our scientific circles, whatever, however beaten down and demoralized and so forth they may be, that there is this fight. And you, Michael, have used the expression, Mike Steger, that your campaign and Keisha's, and you said you're going to continue, and I'm sure you are, is a kind of wedge to shift the United States, to make a radical shift here. Do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, sure. I think we're really at a point of history, and that I think people have to let that really sink in. Mankind can no longer, Lincoln had said it, we can't be either half free or half slave. At this point, mankind cannot continue to tolerate an imperial system subjecting any portion of the human population on this planet and continue to develop. We've actually come to that crossroads. And it's because of the fight we've waged in this country these last, three centuries that has brought us to the point now where we have to redefine what the United States is. And obviously there's no person more significant in defining what the true America is than Mr. LaRouche. And what these campaigns today represent, Keisha's election coming up on Tuesday in Texas, the red of all red states, and the election coming a week after that in San Francisco, the blue of all blue areas of the country, can really demonstrate that there is a unified sense that we are in a crisis. I mean, we see this. We see this from people who come up in the streets to our tables and say, look, I've already voted for you. There was a funny one guy came up and said, you goddamn politicians, you have the same out here just acting like you're going to help something. You're not going to do anything. You're not going to do anything. That's why I voted for this one guy in the voter guidebook who, he didn't sound like a politician at all. He said, we're going to get rid of Obama. He said, Bush and Cheney were fascists too. And he said, we've got to get back to some kind of development. And the organizer said, well, I think you voted for us. And he said, well, who are you? And we said, well, we're with the Steger campaign. He's like, oh, yeah, I voted for you guys. because, the people out there, it's funny, there is an incredible amount of people who feel marginalized by this two-party system, by this political rhetoric, but actually do care about the country. They care about the nation. And they've got to actually get rid of all the cynicism, get rid of all the pessimism, get rid of all the excuses and anger and bitterness of what's happened to the country, and decide today they're going to fight for it. Because we are clearly at a defined historical period where if the United States breaks today, we dump this bomb Obama, and we orient towards what's clearly the only alternative for our own economic success, which is this Pacific collaboration, Russia, China, India, and the rest. We can put mankind into a new economic and scientific period. And I think that's absolutely critical. It's remarkable to be able to participate in that, and I think everyone should do everything possible to help with either the campaigns and just with the fight generally. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, and I'll mention the dates, and then Mike Billington's taken a note here if he wants to say something more. There's a few final minutes, but thanks, Mike Steger. And yes, May 27, if you're listening to this, we archived back 12 years, so but listen to it before May 27, because that's the voting day in Texas for Keisha Rogers. The early voting went May 19 to May 23rd, but May 27 is the voting day. And for Mike Steger, June 3rd. Mike, is there early voting there in the 12th CD?
Yeah, that actually, it's kind of interesting. We have almost 45% of the electorate in the city vote by mail. They've already been voting since May 5th.
Okay, I didn't appreciate that. And I'd like to say one thing, too, that because you, on May 31st, that would be Saturday, a week from now, Keisha Rogers, I think, may join you in person or otherwise by video, right, at a combined event you're hosting in San Francisco. Would you say about that?
Yeah, she'll be here in person. So Keisha and I will both be at an event at the Fort Mason Center Saturday night, May 31st at 7 p.m. And they can call the office for more information. And that's 415-882-7343.
Or I saw it on your website. And so you could, that's, I forget what it is, Mike Steger for, or stegerforcongress.com?
MichaelSteger.us.
Oh, okay, good. If you put in your name, you get it, but okay.
That's right.
And yes, this is, we are changing history. And Mr. Billington here, I think there is only one, you know what, there isn't less than a minute, but do you want to say something?
No, just we're, as I mentioned earlier, we're preparing a major update on the Landbridge Report, what's called the Global Landbridge, or you might say Global Landbridge or Global Holocaust. And I'm going to be putting together a longer piece to review this history of U.S. collaboration with China, with Sun Yat-sen, some of the discussion of the Confucian history, parallel to Western Renaissance thinking. Which I wrote about many years ago when I had a little when I was otherwise detained, so to speak. But I'm going to review some of that now because I think it's so pertinent that people be on top of the fact that we are on the brink of a global renaissance if we can defeat this global Holocaust.
Well, thank you, Mike Steger and Mike Billington. And this will be the close of the May 24th, 2014 LaRue Show. Stay tuned for June, May 31st in June. Thank you. We close out now.
Thank you, Marcia.
Thank you. Bye.